John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The D-Day for ISIS could be approaching. The territorial prize for the part horror show, part invented religion, the leaders in Syria call the Islamic State, is the Iraqi city of Mosul. Take Mosul and ISIS crumbles. That's the military theory of the moment. What would it take and who will be the boots on the ground for this one? And it's alive, the living, loving, lucrative elixir called kombucha. We'll explain how it got from a homebrew bathtub to untold billions. But first, the Sunni-dominated city of Mosul was a thorn in the side of U.S. invaders after 2003. It was home to thousands of former Saddam Hussein loyalists and soldiers kicked out of Baghdad when the U.S. had the brilliant idea to make all former members of the Iraqi military and the Ba'ath Party angry, unemployed men with guns. While the Iraqi government in Baghdad favored Shiite groups, Mosul's loyalty was always dubious, and last June, ISIS easily took the city in a four-day battle with Iraqi troops. ISIS got a civilian airport, a military airport, a border crossing with Syria, a weapons depot, and much more. Once a city of 1.8 million, at least 500,000 people fled after ISIS's invasion, including the city's entire Christian population. Joining us is Mitchell Prothero, Iraq bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He's based in Erbil. Mitchell, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks a lot for having me.
What is it like in Mosul right now, and what are people expecting in the coming weeks?
Well, those are two separate questions in some ways. Obviously, the residents of Mosul, who at this stage really can't leave, the Islamic State has set up checkpoints that basically require you sort of ransom your family if you've got to leave for business to ensure that you'll return. And even if you did want to leave, the Kurds really aren't letting people in from Mosul at this stage anymore into the relatively safe Kurdish areas. So it's a trapped population. Daily life there, I'm told we've got a number of stringers and people who go in and out when they can. It's in some ways better than Raqqa over in Syria, which is also controlled by the Islamic State. It's not quite as tightly controlled and run, you know, in terms of like Islamic law, throwing people off of buildings and stuff. But there is a great deal of fear. You know, if you're a Sunni Muslim living in Mosul, you're looking around and seeing nothing but enemies. Even if you don't particularly like the Islamic State, you're terrified of Shia militias coming up from Baghdad. You are historically not a big fan of the Kurdish Peshmerga. And so I think a lot of these people just feel very, you know, lost and alone and, you know, sort of an impending sense that their city's going to get attacked, at least eventually.
Let's get a feel for what that fear you're talking about sounds like. Here's a Mosul resident named Faisal, according to the BBC, who recorded this account in an audio diary that was broadcast by the BBC last October.
IS members can be seen executing activists in front of everybody in the streets. They wear black fighter outfits, have let their hair and beards grow. Some look as if they haven't seen a shower in ages. Every day they increase in numbers, hold new positions and consolidate their presence, undeterred by the airstrikes from coalition forces, which do nothing to change things on the ground.
Mitchell Prothero, what will change things on the ground? And do people in Mosul believe something could happen?
Well, they're just, like I said, they're just terrified because they're going to be the ones that take the brunt of the fighting if this Iraqi army force that the U.S. has talked about of 25,000 somehow, in my opinion, magically materializes in the next few months. I'm not sure they were that serious when they said they were going to do it in 8 weeks. I guess we'll have to see. I think it was also the Obama administration has been very impatient with just how the Iraqi central government has not been able to really reconstitute a useful or competent military. And so this is somewhat putting a deadline, you know, hoping, I guess, to pressure them into moving forward. But what you're looking at then is going to be, you know, not particularly well-trained troops with American air support attacking a city of 2 million people that, you know, the Islamic State guys have managed to booby trap and burrow into now for, you know, 7-8 months. So it's really got to be a terrifying feeling if you're a Mosul resident. And, you know, you throw it on top that you're not even sure that the liberators that are coming are going to treat you any better than the people occupying you now.
What about the people in military uniform for the United States? So there are plenty of U.S. personnel in Erbil. Do they expect that there may be U.S. soldiers in harm's way in Mosul and possibly there for the taking by ISIS?
Well, that's controversial. Right now, they say no. The administration's been pretty adamant about this. And the guys that are here in Erbil, they're also down in Baghdad at the Baghdad International Airport and in an air base in Al Anbar that are doing training and sort of logistics and what they say brigade level consultations to both the Iraqi and the Kurdish forces. I was speaking with Kurdish fighters. I was on the front lines. I spent a good deal of time on them. Just because they're very close. I mean, Mosul's just, you know, a few dozen kilometers away, and I can drive 20, 30 minutes and practically see the city in the distance while the Kurds fight with them. The Kurds absolutely want U.S. at least special forces or special operations troops to join them to call in the airstrikes.
Mitchell Prothero is Iraq bureau chief for McClatchy newspaper, speaking to us from Erbil. Mitchell, thanks so much.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Let's get into some more detail on this. Joining me now is retired U.S. Colonel Peter Mansour, who served as the executive officer to General David Petraeus during the Iraq surge in 2007-2008. He's now professor of military history at Ohio State University. Colonel, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be on again, John.
So this is no surge. I mean, this is the closest thing to the Battle of Tobruk from World War II, with some very different tactics and technology on both sides if we were to try and take Mosul.
I think a better analogy is the Second Battle of Fallujah in November 2004, in which U.S. forces destroyed about a third of the city and killed 2,000 insurgents in the process. This will be something similar without perhaps so many of the armored vehicles that we used in that battle.
And is it destroy the city to save it? Is that going to be the tactic here, the strategy?
Clearly, the Iraqis do not want to do that. They're very cognizant of the fact that if they destroy Mosul and kill a lot of people, they will alienate the very Sunnis that they're trying to bring back into the fold.
What do you make of the administration's apparent announcement of all of this in advance as a signal to the enemy to dig in even further?
In a word, bizarre. I really can't see a reason to do it. Perhaps if the enemy was weak-kneed and would flee the city, knowing that they were going to be attacked, it would have some use. But this enemy is not going to flee Mosul. They will fight to it with their last dying breath. And just to give them a heads up as to the shape of the battle plan and the sort of the general timing, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
How critical is the air superiority here? There will be no ISIS answer to the air attacks, but there certainly are anti-aircraft in Mosul.
Air superiority is going to be absolutely crucial to this fight. The fact is that the Iraqi army does not have a lot of armored vehicles. When we took Fallujah in November 2004, we used a mechanized brigade with lots of tanks and Bradleys to do it. And they don't have those vehicles, so it's going to be mostly a light infantry fight, and they will need a lot of fire support in order to succeed. And most of that's going to come from the air. Unfortunately, that means a lot of destruction in the city as well. So I'm not sure that the military has thought through how to square the circle here, take Mosul without having a lot of collateral damage in the process.
Now, I'm speculating, but I'm wondering if soldiers in U.S. uniforms have thought through the episode with the Jordanian pilot who found himself in a cage burning alive on a video. And I'm just wondering how much the U.S. forces are concerned about ending up in the hands of ISIS should they be boots on the ground over there.
Well, this has happened before in U.S. history. The prisoners taken by the North Vietnamese were tortured. Now, not many of them were killed, but certainly torture has been part of what the North Koreans did to our service members, the Japanese as well. So the military men and women who serve our nation are trained to resist. And, you know, this is just going to be part of the dangers that they face. And we should be grateful for their service and their willingness to perhaps undergo these very brutal torture and perhaps even death. We should do everything possible to make sure that our service men and women don't get captured.
If you're a civilian in Mosul, I mean, there's no way out. There's nothing you're going to be able to do. There's no evacuation. You're just going to have to hunker down and hope you survive this.
Yeah, pretty tough for the people on the ground. But civilian populations are, you know, they're pretty resilient. You could think of a lot of cities that were fought over in World War II, Brest, Aachen, others in the European continent. And although a lot of civilians were killed, a lot of them survive too. They get down into cellars. They find ways to survive. They flee if they can. But as you've mentioned, ISIS is not allowing people to flee. So this will be tough for the people on the ground. And they're going to have to do the best they can.
This is, as you've stated, bizarrely scheduled for the spring. Any chance this is a decoy and that it will happen earlier or later than that?
Tough to see it happening earlier. I just don't think the forces are ready. We're retraining an Iraqi army that pretty much collapsed in the wake of the invasion by ISIS last summer. I think that they're going to take some time to get their act together. It could be later, though. The Iraqi officials have come forward and said, well, you know, not so fast. It might not be spring. We're going to take our time, get it right. Clearly, they wouldn't want to do this in the heat of the summer. So the other option might be September, October, towards the fall. And we'll just have to see.
Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel, who's now a professor of military history at Ohio State University. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Some passionate responses from you regarding any plan to liberate the Iraqi city of Mosul.
That this has to be done at all is a disgrace to the troops who fought so hard and bled for Mosul the first time. I think Bush was an idiot and Obama enables his idiocy.
This is Richard in Charlotte. I was anti-war in 2003, but we have a responsibility to the Iraqi people and the people of the Middle East to eliminate ISIS as a threat to a peaceful life. These disgusting terrorists have no legitimate claim to the title Islamic.
My name is Laura, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. And I think the U.S. needs to mind their own business and stay out of other countries. We have enough things to worry about in our own country.
It's Ray from Newark, Delaware. What else is the world policeman supposed to do but send the troops in?
From Louisville, Kentucky, no, I most emphatically do not support this because they have told ISIS their plans and given ISIS months to prepare their defense. This will be a bloodbath. From Sukasana, New Jersey, yes, I do. This group is pure evil and needs to be taken out. With that said, I'm also terrified that we will lose troops, or should I say, how many troops will we lose doing this? What do you make of this planned operation? Have your say at 8778MyTake or tweet us at The Takeaway. And still to come, we talk to GT Dave, the founder and owner of GT's Kombucha, that fizzy fermented probiotic drink, of which he now owns half the market share. And that, he says, is just part of a purer way of life. That's later on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You think net neutrality is big? Today, almost exactly 2 years after the song Blurred Lines, you're listening to it now, was released in March of 2013, a trial begins to determine if the hugely popular song by Pharrell Williams, Robin Thicke, and T.I. is actually a ripoff of the song Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye. Listen to Marvin. Well, can you decide? The good news is you don't get to decide. The bad news is whoever does will have their work cut out for them. Musical theft, call it time-shifted collaboration, is, shall we say, not unheard of. Elliot Forrest, midday host on WQXR, WNYC's sister classical music station. Rip-off, tribute, enlightened quotation. Elliot, welcome
borrowing,
to the program.
Stealing, homage.
How do you tell the difference?
Well, I think people can tell the difference, and they know that something is quite similar. I guess I question both historically and in these most recent cases, even with Sam Smith and Stay With Me and Tom Petty, Won't Back Down.
Yeah.
Sam Smith said, I never heard your your song, Old Man. Basically, you know, he put a generation between him and going, I'd never heard that. So you have to wonder whether they did hear it, whether it's in the ether. And even if you go back historically to some of the classical musicians, they didn't have recording technology.
No, no, no.
So a lot of these guys had perfect memory pitch. They'd go hear a concert and either consciously or subconsciously just sort of walk out with it.
So it's not like Barry Manilow rips off Chopin. This is more of an orderly process back in the day.
Well, there's different variations. There's different things. I mean, first of all, sometimes people are upfront about it. Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, he admitted
there you go.
It. Johannes Brahms' Variations on a Theme by Haydn.
There you go.
They were right out front about it.
Very polite.
And Franz Liszt's Fantasy on a Theme from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. So this is what Marriage of Figaro sounds like. Right? And then this is Liszt's version of the same thing. It's a bit of a different theme from a different part of it, but he was upfront about it.
Yeah.
He says, I'm going to take this melody from this opera and make it my own. Liszt did a lot of transcriptions like
a
lot of operatic transcriptions.
What are some more dubious examples?
Well, then Mozart, for example, took an entire symphony by Michael Haydn. This is the younger brother of Franz Joseph Haydn, the more famous, and just added a short introduction, touched up some wind parts, and passed it off as his own. So he calls it Mozart's Symphony No. 37, but it's really Michael Haydn. Of course, you remember that Michael Haydn symphony, don't you?
Yeah, poor Michael Haydn.
And he took it from Mozart. I mean, now he's got not only Mozart stealing from him, but he's got that competitive thing with his older brother.
Amadeus.
You know, this happens all the time, especially with Broadway. There's a lot of melodies. Andrew Lloyd Webber, the guys from Liszt, from Les Mis, for example. If you listen to the humming chorus from Puccini's Madame Butterfly and then Bring Him Home, it's exactly the same melody. Exactly. So there's a lot of not just pop tunes, but Broadway is often going back and forth. There's a somewhat...
And Puccini's not around to... You know, hire a lawyer.
To defend himself anymore. No. There's a somewhat famous story that Andrew Lloyd Webber had just finished writing Memory from Cats, and he had been known to sort of like borrow, steal, homage to Puccini in the past, and it's such a beautiful melody, that Memory from Cats. He called up his father, who was also a musician, and said, I'm afraid I've taken this. What does this sound like to you? And he plays it for him over the phone, and his father said, it sounds like $1 million to me.
And it was.
And it was at least that, and it looks like it might be coming back to Broadway.
So the intellectual property idea is very modern. It wasn't really the same kind of thing back in, you know, the 1800s.
Well, I mean, if you want to go back, I think the most egregious one that I've always loved is there's a tune you know, and I'll get to it in a minute as to why you know it. But Bach took this tune for the St. Matthew Passion from a guy named Hans Leo Hassler in the 15th century.
Poor Hans.
And he's not around to defend himself at all. So let's hear the Hans Leo Hassler original.
My good is
sound familiar yet? Do you know why you know it?
A little bit. I don't know why I know it.
All right, I'll tell you why you know it, but let's do the Bach version. This is the St. Matthew Passion taken from the Hans Leo Hassler. No credit whatsoever. This is the Bach St. Matthew Passion, not crediting Hans Leo Hassler. Did you know why you know it yet?
I don't know why I know it, but I definitely know it. I'm feeling the ether here.
All right. Let's play Paul Simon.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused.
And none of this goes into court.
No, there's a lyric in a friend song, my friend John Forrester, that Hans Leo Hassler wrote this in 1599. This is quoting Paul Simon in the song. I changed one or two notes, and now ASCAP says it's mine.
And, you know, the theme from All Things Considered, I believe, on public radio, comes from Carl Maria von Weber.
Is that right? I wasn't aware of that.
Or maybe
one.
A Brahms. I don't know. It's a classical quotation.
Here's the thing that I don't really understand. There's only eight notes, and that means C twice. I mean, I don't know how you're going to avoid this.
Well, Schoenberg would have said 12.
Right. 12 if you want to slice it up a little bit differently. So it's impossible for me to figure out how even an, I mean, have we run out of melodies, John? Are there new melodies to be written?
I guess the lines are just blurred. Right, Elliot?
Play Dvorak's Ninth Symphony and then play the theme from Jaws, too, if you want to have some fun.
Oh,
hearing
that's
that.
A good one.
Yeah.
What do you think are some famous ripoffs of the past musically? We'd love to hear from you, 8778-MY-TAKE, or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, Elliot.
Great fun. Thanks, John.
Elliot Forrest, midday host on WQXR, WNYC's sister classical music station.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second-best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th.
Now, nobody is going to give you an argument about drinking this stuff.
Kombucha, the actual word, is Japanese.
Right.
So kombu means seaweed, mm-hmm. and cha means tea. So together it's seaweed tea.
And that slightly fizzy, medicinal-tasting elixir available in your local market is the meaning of life in a bottle.
It's almost kind of a metaphor or a symbol of how people should live their life.
Kombucha is a drink, and don't be fooled. This fellow is a salesman, not a doctor or philosopher, with the very Californian name of G.T. Dave. He is the engine behind the commercial kombucha craze here in the U.S. No seaweed, G.T. Dave's kombucha is a fermented probiotic beverage made with tea, bacteria, and yeast, with an estimated $600 million of retail sales. And at least half of that will be for G.T. Dave's brand, who was there first. G.T. Dave is profiled in the March issue of Inc. magazine, an entrepreneur with sandals and a Lamborghini and a constant smile.
I was raised by two very holistic and spiritual parents that not only raised me a vegetarian, but also took me to India at an early age to meet with this holy man named Sai Baba and stay at his ashram. Although I was baptized and raised Catholic, I had this interesting blend of religion, yet spirituality, and kind of a Western perspective with Eastern philosophies. But at the tender age of a teenager, kombucha came into my life, and my parents were making it and drinking it and trying to get me to drink it. But I, of course, thought this was just another weird thing that my parents were trying to get me into because, again, my parents raised me with tofu and wheatgrass and aloe vera juice and chia seeds and things that most kids aren't familiar with. It wasn't until a couple years later, after my parents had been drinking it for a while, that my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it came to be that kombucha helped her through her experience. Now, it didn't cure her, but it did keep her strong and healthy and resilient throughout her battle with breast cancer and throughout the treatments that she chose to go through. So it was her success that really inspired me.
So do you think of yourself as a kind of Oprah character, or are you more just a basic businessman?
I mean, if those are the two options for descriptors, I would definitely say Oprah. I do live my life that I don't want to be on my deathbed and say, God, I made so much money, or God, I own so many great things, or God, I was so famous. I really want to say, wow, I really lived my life to the fullest, and I touched as many people as I could, and I left a positive mark. And if the things that I did and the decisions I made allowed people to rethink some of their decisions or some of their options for their life, then I've lived my life.
Why do you think you have such a big market share? Is it the packaging? What is it?
It's the cute name. No, it's you know what it is I'm a firm believer that some of the greatest successes come from pure intentions. And not to toot my own horn or stroke myself, but one of the things that I feel very blessed to have and to have experienced was that kind of humble beginning of just being so young and so kind of innocent and just seeing the world through such an innocent lens that I just want to do something great. And because that has remained in what we do, I think people resonate with that. Because we don't try to force what we're doing down people's throats and we don't have any slogans.
You don't force it down their throats, but definitely putting it down their throats.
We gently pour it down their throats.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But because, I mean, I've taken kind of an unconventional path to everything that I do, whether it's the labels, whether it's the brand messaging, whether it's the choices that I make with my company or the relationships that I choose to engage, it kind of keeps things really pure. And the driving force is just to do something great. And whether I sell one bottle or 1 billion bottles, as long as I'm doing something great, that's all that matters to me. And I think it speaks a universal language that I think resonates really well with people. And and then you have these loyalists that are loyal because they genuinely love it.
GT Dave is the founder and owner of GT's Kombucha, which owns half of the market share of commercial kombucha.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
On the 8th of March last year, it was a tragic plane crash.
The past few hours, the Malaysian authorities have released new information about the search for a missing plane that vanished.
Yeah, we have new information about the flight path. It fills in some very important blanks.
Then it was a string of incompetent government officials delivering incomplete or meaningless statements.
From the day the aircraft lost contact and disappeared from our radar, there's no signal being able to be detected.
Flight MH370 ended in a sudden Indian Ocean.
Then it was just pure speculation.
What if it was hijacking or terrorism or mechanical failure or pilot error? But what if it was something fully that we don't really understand? Black holes and on and on and on and all of these conspiracy theories. Just look at this.
A high-tech tale of mapping the bottom of the ocean or looking at complicated satellite data to find that thumbprint in the sky of the plane that was and then it wasn't. Always there were the tears on the faces of the families of the people on that Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 that suddenly disappeared on a planned trajectory from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Where is it? 9% of people responding to a CNN poll thought it was either very or somewhat likely that the plane was abducted by aliens, time travelers, or beings from another dimension, which perhaps tells you more about who watches CNN than anything to do with aviation. Some of those people were watching science journalist Jeff Wise when he said this on CNN last year.
What about, though, the theory that a lot of people have, which is that they wanted to take this jet, commandeer it for some sort of a future attack, whether that was to load it up immediately with some sort of half radioactive material and fly it over a city?
No, come on. It's time to have a reality check.
No, I believe this one, actually.
Well, it's time for you to have a reality check.
I think you should have a reality check.
That's Jeff Wise saying, no, I believe this one. He tracked all the theories during his stint as a CNN on-air consultant, and then his on-the-job obsession became the basis for how crazy am I to think I actually know where the Malaysian Airlines plane is, published in this week's issue of New York Magazine. Hello, Jeff Wise.
Hello.
And that was quite a journey you took there, being an aviation expert for CNN during those weeks and months.
It was really nuts. And out of the blue, I mean, I was living a normal life. And all of a sudden, I was sucked up into this UFO ship of CNN 24/7 MH370 coverage.
And before we tick off the conspiracy theories, let's just note this is a tragedy. These people are disappeared. We don't know what happened to them. And their grief extends to this moment. But what were the conspiracy theories that you observed in your investigation of this?
In the first couple of weeks, almost anything was possible. And so we had a very famous one that involved these hero pilots whose cockpit had filled with smoke and they turned around to try to stage a landing. There was another theory that the plane had tucked up under another plane and sort of hidden in its radar shadow.
I missed that one.
Yeah, that was a good one. Ultimately, though, what happened was this Inmarsat data became released. And so everything we know now about the final 6 hours of this flight comes from a very small handful of these hard-to-decipher signals that were transmitted between the plane and the satellite.
And we know that's valid. I mean, that's a real data. I mean, our folks here went nuts when that story broke. I mean,
this is the perfect fodder for conspiracy theorists of every stripe, because we just – it's so hard just at first glance to tell what is good information and what is bad information. And once a bad piece of information comes out, in this day and age, it never really goes away. You've got these blogs and other people venting their opinions, seizing on a report or a rumor or an eyewitness sighting or something that washed up on a beach in the Maldives or something. From this assemblage of data, you can put together whatever you want.
So the title of your article is How Crazy Am I to Think I Actually Know Where the Malaysia Airlines Plane Is? Do you think you know?
It's such a complicated tale that the 4,000 words I put together for New York Magazine for me was like writing haiku. To really give the full picture, I put out a Kindle single that explains it at much longer length. It's called The Plane That Wasn't There. To try to understand these seven pings, if you recall, the handshake pings that were exchanged between the satellite and the plane, you have to get into the satellite orbital mechanics, the configuration of the avionics on the plane, the algorithms that are in the computer system of the autopilot and the frequency compensation that takes place in the satellite communications. I mean, it gets very complicated very quickly. And one of the real challenges facing those of us who are trying to piece this all together is to find the sources of information. For instance, Boeing, which builds the 777,
right,
doesn't really make it easy to find out how these electrical components are wired together. So one of the arcane but very important questions we were trying to solve was the plane disappeared from Malaysian radar, and it was completely invisible and completely dark over the Andaman Sea somewhere. And then the satellite system gets turned back on. And this is a very baffling and surprising and significant event that we're still trying to make sense of, because we're trying to figure out how do you turn on a satellite communication system, and you can't just go to the owner's manual of a 777 because they don't publish it. So one of the reasons I wanted to publish this theory is that hopefully people might come out of the woodwork and say, hey, I used to work for Honeywell Avionics, or I used to work for Boeing, and I can tell you how these systems are wired together. I can tell you what isn't possible.
Do you believe the people who are on that plane are no longer with us?
So basically, I put this theory together trying to say, is it possible that since we found no debris, is it in any way conceivable that that data is not correct? Is there some way it could be wrong? And I say it is actually technically, physically possible through a very arcane series of steps to fake it. And if they did fake it, the plane could have gone north. Not only could it have gone north, but we have a pretty good idea of where it would have gone based on the remaining data that we can trust. In that case, those people could be alive.
That's just
– I think they're probably not alive.
Yeah, but we would have heard from them if they
– This is where we get with this story, however. It's like my gut tells me that, yes, most likely – we would have heard from these people. Most likely would have seen this plane on radar, but most likely we should have seen debris in the southern Indian Ocean too. And you get this kind of vague gut feeling of we should have seen something, or something should have happened.
All right, one more question then. If it is the case that the plane's on the bottom of the sea, were the people on that plane mostly dead or alive when it was in the air over the sea?
We have no idea.
No,
I mean, it's just that we have no evidence that all we know about the final 6 hours of this plane are these seven pings that tell us, you know, and there's so many ways you can crunch those numbers to tell you somewhere over the southern Indian Ocean it was flying probably straight, possibly on autopilot.
And this case has spooked every pilot, yes?
I think a lot of pilots look at this case and say this doesn't add up. When the whole points of aircraft and accident investigation is to say, let's figure out what went wrong so we can fix it so that the system won't permit this to happen again. And this case is unique in that we can't do that.
Jeff Wise, journalist and aviation analyst. He writes about his experience as a CNN aviation analyst in a story entitled How Crazy Am I to Think I Actually Know Where the Malaysia Airlines Plane Is, published in this week's issue of New York Magazine. Thanks, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks.
This road is much less of a mystery, but certainly still controversial. The road to an open internet. Our series continues. We're asking you, how is the web where you live?
Hey, this is Jess from Silicon Valley. Believe it or not, out here we only have two choices, Comcast or AT&T. I really think this is unacceptable to just have two companies in the Silicon Valley.
Well, that conversation will continue on Thursday at 5 p.m. We're hosting a Twitter chat about net neutrality. You can visit thetakeaway.org for more information on how you can be a part of it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.